Your Grace, Your Eminence, my Venerable Spiritual Father, Father Ephraim, Reverend Abbesses, Holy Abbots, ladies and gentlemen. This is the final session, the ninth in order, and there is a change in the program. Father Luke of Philotheo, who was to speak but is absent for reasons beyond his control, had as his subject the life of Saint Joseph the Hesychast. Geronta, it would have been of great interest to us to hear this, concerning our request that the talks, or rather the letters, of Saint Joseph be published just as they came from his own hand, since Father Luke is the one who prepared the edition. As we had already said, and as I myself said in my presentation, it is good for us to have the letters of Saint Joseph exactly as they came from his own hand. In any case, in his place, His Eminence Metropolitan Nicolaus of Mesogaia and Lavreotiki will speak on the subject, the pastoral dimension of the work of Saint Joseph the Hesychast, please. Mr. Chairman, anyone who looks carefully at the program will notice two discrepancies. One is of secondary importance, while the other is particularly significant. The first is that every session has three speakers except this one, which has two. I do not think that matters very much. The other can be noticed only by someone who is fairly good at mathematics. While every other speaker has been allotted 20 minutes, this speaker has been given 30. I do not know whether this is an accidental error or a blatant show of favor. So do you want 30 minutes or 20? No, 25 minutes. I shall give the other 5 minutes to Father Athanasios, though we shall see how long this takes. The person of Saint Joseph the Hesychast, especially in light of everything we have heard over these past days, is identified with absolute flight from the world, an unyielding insistence on the conditions required for Hesychiah, an uncompromising devotion to undistracted prayer, the continual effort to compel oneself in the ascetic struggle, and an exceptionally great love for the desert. It would not be easy for anyone to associate the life of such a man with the image of a pastor. When we have before us a champion and lover of Hesychiah, how can we speak of the pastoral dimension of his work? The Hesychast is not a pastor who speaks and mingles with people, nor an activist who produces visible works. Saint Joseph, however, was both a Hesychast and an elder, a spiritual father. He was and remains a pastor who shepherded thirsty souls and continues to shepherd them to this day. He is a guide who not only teaches but also inspires and initiates souls into the mystery. Through his word, he begets spiritual children. Although he is an uncompromising Hesychast, with a strong inclination towards solitude and an unyielding love for silence and Hesychiah, he simultaneously shows a remarkable concern for souls struggling in the world. He does not live the reality of salvation in isolation, for himself alone, but within the church and together with his brethren. His extensive correspondence, the fruits of his life, and both the close and the wider circles of his disciples all demonstrate this. The pastoral ministry of Saint Joseph has a strongly monastic and philokalic orientation. Prayer and Assisi's ascetic discipline stand at its heart. He speaks continually about these things. His teaching is addressed either to monks or to faithful people who choose to live in the world according to monastic standards and to undertake the ascetic work of noetic prayer. In his letters, writings, and teaching, we rarely encounter subjects concerning relations between husbands and wives, the upbringing of children, family ethics, vocational guidance, and so forth. His words and thought are concerned more with God and less with man, more with the mystery and less with natural reasoning, more with grace and less with the fall. In this sense, the pastoral ministry of Saint Joseph is unusual, specialized, and monastically oriented. Its principal characteristics are as follows. First, he is methodical and clear in presenting his teaching. When studying his letters and catechetical instructions, we can properly speak of a coherent body of teaching. In these texts, we find precise descriptions that dissect the hidden states of the soul, an impressive analysis of its workings and of the pathology of its weaknesses, and detailed portrayals of the spiritual struggle. He knows well how the passions operate, what they conceal, and how they manifest themselves. He therefore does not speak theoretically or vaguely. His words possess authenticity, power, and persuasiveness. They have the character of an original, first-hand text. He is not content with general, vague words of comfort and encouragement. In a deeply personal manner, he offers a theological analysis of spiritual states and experiences, of the ways in which the grace of God acts, and of the soul's dialogue with God. Second, his language is simple and unpolished, As is clearly evident from his writings, he lacked worldly education and possessed the pure and undefiled character of a little child. His language is therefore unpolished and filled with images and examples drawn from nature. This simplicity, vividness, and expressiveness make the man himself approachable and his words easy to understand. Third, he is deeply emotional, gentle, and tender. There can be no doubt that the teaching of the fathers of Nepsis, watchfulness concerning tears according to God, is a profoundly important truth. If it were passed over in silence or somehow misunderstood, the truth itself would be wounded. Nevertheless, the manner and frequency with which he speaks of these tears also reveal certain elements of natural human feeling. Saint Joseph does not hesitate to refer frequently and spontaneously to the experience of tears. In this way, he warms his pastoral words, sometimes even using exaggerated figures of speech. For example, he says in one place, "My eyes flowed like fountains, and I did not cease praying until the ground had turned to mud." Beyond this, however, his words and the ways he addresses his spiritual children. And the women who seek his monastic counsel are marked by a rare and sometimes daring tenderness and sweetness. He uses expressions such as "treasure of my soul, beloved child, my dearly beloved little child, inmost part of my soul, my sacred daughter, my good dove, my little child, little butterfly, and I cover you with kisses as my son and pray for you as my beloved." He expresses his feelings openly, offers encouragement, and participates personally in their struggle. It is striking that these tender and gentle words come from the same mouth which, when training the monks under obedience to him in Assisi, does not shrink from severe rebukes and reprimands or even insults. Fourth, he is exhortatory. His texts abound in imperatives and encouraging exhortations. You feel that he himself is beside you, urging you forward. You cannot but advance. In one representative passage, he says, "Come to your senses then and cast these thoughts out of your nous, your spiritual intellect. Force yourself toward every good thing. Continually make metanoia, repentance, whenever you err, and do not waste time. So force yourselves, keep silence, pray, obey, and humble yourselves that you may find every good thing." Fifth, he is extreme, absolute, and heroic. Alongside his warm and emotionally rich language, one encounters an unbending and heroic element, uncompromising and unyielding, which truly reveals the greatness of his ascetic soul. It has such power that it carries along those who receive his teaching. At one point, he says characteristically, giving the vivid impression that he himself is living what he describes, "Let blood flow from the extreme exertion of the Jesus prayer. Let yourself collapse for weeks, exhausted like someone gravely ill. You must struggle with all your strength. The body must always be enslaved to the spirit. Do not spare it in the least. Become a sponge that soaks your soul not in honors and praises, but in reproaches and accusations for which you bear no blame." Elsewhere, he speaks even more forcefully, "Become a corpse for everyone to trample underfoot. Become earth. Beat, strike, and hate yourself as an implacable enemy." He also says elsewhere, "In the beginning I fought against the carnal passions. I did not sleep on my side, but standing in a corner or sitting on a stool. I beat myself 2 or 3 times a day, howling and weeping until my body collapsed. I broke many sticks across my thighs." Sixth, he possesses discernment and is full of understanding. Although he is so absolute and demanding, he is also filled with kindness and understanding. He writes, "Do not despair, these things happen to everyone, it is an assault of temptation and it will pass. From that moment onward I have suffered and prayed for you, so do not be sorrowful. We are human beings and transgressors like children. We bear the negligence of our forefathers as sin. The Lord will show us this loving condescension, and through metanoia, repentance, he forgives everything. Although he is an uncompromising hesychast, he also makes himself a participant in the needs of the soul. He himself acknowledges this, and it is also evident from the great abundance of his writings. When he realizes that he is not understood, he does not enter into discussions, negotiations, or explanations. He simply makes his decisions, including decisions for his disciples, without explaining them. They must later try to discern the reasons behind his words. Seventh, his descriptions of unseen warfare are vivid. When he speaks of the attacks of the evil one, he is especially graphic. He is also descriptive and methodical when explaining how the spiritual struggle is organized. And when revealing the deeper causes of temptations, at one point he says, "For all 8 years, every day was a martyrdom. the demons would flee, crying out, "He has burned us, he has burned us." It happened one night that the brother beside me also heard them, wondering who those shouting were, and I turned and saw the demon as it truly was. His words are also theological, not barren, dry moralizing. He does not waste time on moralistic lectures. His teaching has doctrinal substance. It is spiritual and refers to truths that permeate everything, rather than to superficial behavior. Ninth, his writings are rich in bold accounts of personal experience. His words are accompanied and confirmed by experiences of this kind. Thus, he writes somewhere, "Listen to something that happened to me." He speaks so personally that he could even be misunderstood, as though he were indirectly drawing attention to himself and giving way to pride. He says, "When I was in the world, I would take on 1,000 adversaries, and by enduring, by strangling Satan within me, and through the utmost patient endurance, I was delivered from evil, and as soon as I had said the Jesus prayer a few times, I was immediately caught up into theoria, into divine vision. Although I was inside the cave and its door was shut, I found myself outside, in heaven, in a wondrous place, in utter peace and serenity of soul, in perfect rest." Something similar also happened to me, he says elsewhere. "Once, with the late Theodora, I even felt her breath beside me, although she was living in the world, and I was here on the holy mountain." Tenth, he is a shepherd whose prayer is active and effective. His pastoral ministry is founded not upon the advice he gives, but upon the prayer he offers. This is why he insists upon prayer, speaks about prayer, exhorts others to pray, and himself prays for his own soul, for others, for the whole world, and for each person individually. His own prayer and the hard struggle it entails are the necessary complement to the prayers of his spiritual children. He says in one place, "And then the prayer I offer on your behalf will immediately take effect. My child, you seek the heavenly city. But your elder prays for this, the fathers pray for it, and I too, poor as I am, pray here among the rocks. For every soul that receives help, I myself undergo the warfare that soul is facing." The 11th element is the necessity of a sign. His spiritual teaching requires confirmation through evidence that transcends this world. Therefore, being at home in the spiritual world, a fact attested by signs, he often refers to such signs. He says in one place, "Elder Kalinikos tasted the rapture of the nose. Elder Gerasimos, though struck by the thunderbolts of the storms, remained an unshaken pillar of patient endurance. Through the Jesus prayer, Elder Ignatius gave forth a fragrance from his mouth, so that one delighted to speak close to his mouth. Papa Daniel reached the end of his life at a very advanced age without illness. Another elder, 90 years old, told us that he had lived on a mountaintop for 17 years. Thunderbolts would fall and tear his clothes, yet he showed the utmost patient endurance and so forth. There was also a Russian who shed tears unceasingly night and day. He was entirely lifted above earthly things and filled with theoria, with divine vision. He also had the gift of foresight, for he knew beforehand who was coming. Elder Joseph's illumined pastoral ministry transforms God's astonishing intervention from an unexpected miracle into the expectation of a sign. A 12th element is the presence of the Theotokos in our lives. His bond with the person of the Most Holy Theotokos is clearly evident and distinct within his pastoral ministry. Like all the saint fathers of our own time, known and unknown, renowned and obscure, he passed through the Most Holy Theotokos in expressing the very best of his inner world and the finest expressions of his faith. This is precisely what happened with Elder Joseph. In a deeply personal letter he writes, "I cannot kiss the icon of the Most Holy Theotokos only once and then leave. When I draw near to her, she pulls me toward her like a magnet, and I must be alone, because I want to spend hours kissing her icon. I shall conclude with one final characteristic: the transmission of the Spirit and of grace that takes place through him." He did not merely describe his experiences, he also bestowed experience and the power of piety upon others. Although he is precise when discussing technique and giving practical counsel, he is also spontaneous in transmitting experience. He speaks both about technique and about experience, about the road and its destination, about the holy canon, the rule, and the blessed exception. He does not merely offer teachings and admonitions, his words are also personal and born of experience. Indeed, he continues to speak even after his death. The proof is the fruit of his life. His grace is transmitted to his spiritual children, and its fruit is the renewal of the holy mountain and of noetic prayer. At a time when the number of monks in the monasteries of the Holy Mountain was declining dangerously, he, though following strict ascetic disciplines of an uncompromisingly hesychastic kind, formed a large brotherhood with numerous disciples and an entire school of life rooted in nepsis, watchfulness. What is striking is that all his disciples not only continued the tradition he had established, but themselves became elders and spiritual fathers to many new monks, who contributed greatly to the modern renewal of Attonite monasticism. Indeed, as was mentioned earlier, three of them became abbots of major monasteries on the Holy Mountain. Today, six monasteries represent the tradition carried on by his spiritual descendants, and all of this bore fruit after his departure from this life. It was accomplished by the grace of God, yet through his prayer. The grace of the saint is transmitted to his spiritual children and through them still farther to people at a distance, to strangers and even after his death. Elder Joseph shows us the image of the spiritual father. Not one who merely gives advice, but one who initiates others into the mystery. Not one who persuades with arguments, but one who inspires. Not one who is anxious, but one who loves. Not one who possesses psychological knowledge, but one who lives spiritual realities. Not one who understands merely with the intellect, but one who prays noetically. Not one who imposes his presence, but one who himself doubts and questions his own spiritual gift. He is not the one who searches for us, but the one to whom we ourselves run. He is not the one whom we see living, but the one whom we sense never dies. He is not one who preaches God as a proposition to be proved, but one who reveals him as a sign in his own life and in ours. Active prayer and the ability to transmit the gifts of grace are surely the finest pastoral ministry. Thank you. We thank His Eminence very much. He observes the 18-minute limit with absolute precision. Only 18 minutes he may continue if he wishes. That leaves Father Athanasius plenty of time. With great vividness, clarity, and simplicity, he has given us 13 elements of Elder Joseph's pastoral ministry. And I would venture to say, Your Eminence of Limassol and Elder Ephraim, that Elder Joseph truly is a shepherd and a father of the Church. And I do not know, my learned professors, whether it would be too much to say that he may also be called the teacher of the Church. Perhaps this is a subject that ought to be examined. In Joseph's case, I believe it is right to consider whether the title of father and teacher of the Church may be bestowed upon him.